You're listening to In the Studio with Bob Reed and Blair Peckham on News Talk 1010.
Hey there, Blair Peckham.
Hello, Bob Reed.
Happy end of Canadian Music Week.
Yes.
Winding down for another year.
Busy week it was.
Always. Always. That's the annual gathering of literally the entire Canadian music industry and players from around the world.
Absolutely. And radio, too, from across Canada. Mm-hmm. Radio personalities, radio programmers, music directors. It's a pretty great gathering.
Yeah. As usual, we were smart enough to pass a tape recorder back and forth, and so we've gathered some things that we're going to share with folks, I think, in dribs and drabs going forward. Most of the discussion is pretty timeless. So
yeah, I think so. So over the next few weeks, you'll be hearing some highlights from our visit to Canadian Music Week. Mm-hmm. Now, who knows? Other people may have had a better time than us, but I don't think so.
I doubt it, yeah. Speaking of Canadian music, the second half of this show is going to focus. Well, actually, the whole show is, but the second half will focus on a new act. Now, there are a couple of veterans in the band, three ladies who wear the maple leaf proudly on their sleeves, I guess. Trent Severn is the name of the act, and all three of them are very, very talented.
I am acquainted with all three of them in different ways. I knew Dana Manning when she opened for my ex and I, the lovely Arlene Bishop. Dana Manning opened a few shows for us when she was, seriously, I thought she was 10, but in fact, she was maybe 16. And she was fantastic. I remember thinking, oh my God, this is what we're up against. And then M. Greiner, of course, friend of the show, and somebody, you know, we both know very well. Also, Laura C. Bates, the wild card. She was a student of mine at Humber College in my songwriting class. She's playing violin and writing songs and singing beautifully with Trent Severn.
It's a wonderful record, and looking forward to having the three of them join us. But speaking of Canadian music, our first guest has some great tales to tell.
From 9 to 5, I have to spend my time at work. My job is very boring, I'm an office clerk. The only thing that helps me pass the time away is knowing I'll be back at Echo Beach someday.
Jerry Young was promotion manager at PolyGram Records when he left in 1982 to form his own label called Current Records and Management. In a career that spans over 40 years, Jerry has managed to work with nearly everyone in the music business you can think of in one capacity or another, and he's written a book about those experiences. I love the title, Pop Goes the Weasel, in which Jerry tells the tall tales everyone wants to hear about the music industry's heyday. Welcome, Jerry Young. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Blair.
In reading the book, and the full title is Pop Goes the Weasel, Rock and Roll Off the Record, you seem kind of like the Zelig of the music business, popping up here and there with everybody you can think of. I mean, you're with Johnny Winter, you're with Dire Straits, you're with Kiss, the Village People, Randy Bachman. Did it feel like that for you? Does it, thinking back on it?
You know, at the time, I think Patti Smith said this in her book, as a matter of fact. At the time, it just felt like you were living life. You had a decent job, and you were meeting some fun people. But you didn't look in the historical sense of it at all until later, of course, which was in after around 2005, 2006. I started thinking of, wow, you know, some of these people, most of them, as a matter of fact, are still around. Most of them are still playing live. Most of them are still putting out records. And I thought to myself, you know, there might be something here that I should share with people. And it took about a year to, you know, off and on to write the book and had some success with it so far.
And when you're dealing with new artists at the time, you've got no way of knowing if they're going to be, you know, a big deal one day or maybe a flash in the pan.
No, absolutely. And, you know, that happened so many times that I'd meet people who, frankly, were maybe one-hit wonders and then turned out to be absolute superstars like Mark Knopfler, Dire Straits, and, you know, the list goes on. But so many artists came through town in those 3 years of PolyGram, which is like Universal now. It was the biggest label in the world and had basically, I would say, half the major bands in the world.
Yes.
on the associated labels they had, including RSO, which had the Bee Gees and all the soundtracks, Grease and Saturday Night Fever, etc. So there was a lot of money rolling through and a lot of parties going down and a lot of fun being had. And I felt I was playing the rock and roll game for free, so it was fun.
Your first official duty at PolyGram was to ferry Randy Bachman around town. But it was sort of a pivotal moment for you.
Well, it sort of was, because I'd been with the company only about a week and a half, and already I'd taken a Learjet flight, sign of the rock and roll business at that point, taking a Learjet flight around Toronto to Niagara Falls, listening to the Allman Brothers Band and the Cooper Brothers Band from Ottawa, drinking champagne with Phil Walden from Capricorn Records. And, about a week after that, Jean-Marie, who was my boss, Jean-Marie Heimrath, who I'm sure you guys all know.
Yeah.
Jean-Marie said to me, okay, now you got to sort of get on the horse. Randy Bachman's coming to town, so you set up some interviews and chauffeur him around town. So that was the first actual major artist that I actually took a couple of days touring around town and had some real fun, although the choice of restaurants seemed to be the same. It was the Sai Wu Chinese restaurant on Dundas Street that Randy insisted we go back to for breakfast, lunch, and dinner the 2 days he was there.
And he ordered the same thing.
Yeah, same thing. He must have been on a diet or something. He's a big man. I think he was trying to slim down. And they were quiet dinners. It was tea, and it was rice.
Right, it wasn't partying stuff.
No, matter of fact, yeah. I felt a bit out of place. I ordered a beer, but Randy didn't, so I found out later maybe I had something to do with the fact he was a Mormon.
Right, mm-hmm. Right, yeah. You said that experience led you to feel that you had officially become a rock and roll weasel.
Absolutely. I, at that point in time, after I saw Randy off at the airport, I thought to myself, well, I sort of broken my virginity on this, and there was a disparaging term I'm sure you've all heard of called weasel in the record business. Artists refer to record company weasels consistently if yes. They don't get something that they want out of the label. So I officially figured, I guess I'm officially now a rock and roll weasel, so there it goes. And thus the title of the book.
Indeed. Pop Goes the Weasel, Rock and Roll Off the Record is the book. Jerry Young is the author, and he's in studio with us. Some of the other names that, this is always the fun part when somebody writes a rock and roll memoir, right? You can just pick off some of the big names. Kiss was a band that you weren't really crazy about at first, right?
Well, I actually am not into headbanging music particularly. I never have been, never was, but, I like AC/DC, I like Metallica, bands like that. At the same time, Kiss was one of those bands who I just thought was sort of, juvenile. And so I didn't really think much of them in the makeup and the whole getup. But, of course, they were one of the bands I had to take care of when they came through. They were on Casablanca Records, which is one of the affiliated labels with PolyGram. So they were playing Maple Leaf Gardens, and we had a radio photographed with all the radio people backstage set up ahead of time. And they weren't coming out from the dressing room, and the show was about to go on. And I went in and tried to get them, and they wouldn't let me in because they were getting made up, and they didn't want anybody to see them and all the rest. Anyway, they eventually came out, eventually very polite, did the photographs. They looked, of course, ridiculous because
in
they
their
were
full regalia.
Full regalia. I mean, monster boots and standing about 8 foot tall and dwarfing over me for certain. And I sort of looked up at Gene and said, well, thanks for coming out and doing this. And he looked at me, and at that time he had a very thick Bronx accent. And he said, no problem, man. And I thought to myself, this is unreal. Here's this monster looking face with 9 feet tall, feet boots that are sort of weird. And he's saying, no problem, man. It was sort of weird. But then they came on stage. And I'd never seen a show like it, frankly. I'd seen Triumph, who set off a lot of smoke bombs, but I'd never seen Kiss live before. And, Gene going 50 feet into the air and then over the audience of Maple Leaf Gardens to the back of the bloody building and then on the way back to the stage and then landing. And Peter Criss going 30 feet up in the air and spinning in his drum seat. I thought to myself, this is unbelievable. So I gave him a lot of credit. A hell of a show.
Jerry Young is in the studio. His book is Pop Goes the Weasel, Rock and Roll Off the Record. It's available now through Amazon and any fine retailer where books are sold. We'll take a quick break here and be back with lots more in the studio on In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010.
You're listening to In the Studio with Bob Reed and Blair Peckham on News Talk 1010.
Rolls away with memories of killing time and dreams. Think of me, it was so cold. We burned. And as they
some music there from one of the artists. Managed and recorded by our guest. Jerry Young is his name. Pop Goes the Weasel, Rock and Roll Off the Record is his book, and it's available everywhere now. A real long list of Canadian success stories in the 80s that you were part of. Martha and the Muffins, Parachute Club, Strange Advance, Molly Johnson and Altamoda. Tell us about that era for you. You had left PolyGram to start your own label, which was, that strikes me as probably unusual for the time.
Well, actually, Bob, I left PolyGram in 1980. The reason I left was a band called Martha and the Muffins, who just had a hit with Echo Beach in England. It was just being released in Canada, came to me, and I'd met them a couple of times before. And they said, we're about to quit. And I said, what do you mean you're about to quit? And they said, well, we're not getting along with our record company, Virgin, in England, and we just can't handle them anymore. They're making outlandish requests of us, like we switch around the lead singers, we do this, we do that, and we have nobody who can really fight against. We're managed by ourselves at the moment. And would you consider quitting PolyGram and managing us? And I thought to myself, wow, this is quite something. yeah. You know, I've got a steady good gig here. But I was getting a bit tired of the nights at the Alma Combo and Sneaky D's looking at bands. And so I thought to myself, you know, this could be it. So I listened to the band first album and heard another album, their second album, which called Trance and Dance, which subsequently failed, by the way, miserably, but it wasn't out yet at that point. So I was looking at a band who had a hit, and it was a hit right now.
Yeah.
And I asked everybody around me that I trusted, should I drop this job PolyGram and go manage the band? And everybody said no. That's a ridiculous move because, in fact, bands are one-hit wonders, and you know, forget it. So naturally, I chose to quit PolyGram and
to ignore all that
good advice and manage the band and start to manage the band. And it was a rough couple of years because the second album did come out and it did fail. And it looked like things were, you know, wrapping up. But we still had, you know, a lot of hope and we still had a lot of guts. And I had a bit of money so I could live for a while and help the band out. And we, you know, did this for a couple of years, and then 1982 came along, and Virgin said, okay, we're dropping a lot of our bands, but we want to keep Martha and the Muffins, but we're going to undercut you on the contract that called for the third option, or the second option. We're going to offer them $75,000, not $120,000, which the contract called for. So I eventually mentioned that to the band's lawyer, and the band's lawyer said to me, what do you think of starting our own record company? And I said, well, that's great. Come up with $150,000 and let's talk about it. We'll sign Martha and the Muffins as our first band. About a week later, I got a phone call from Joe Fedor, who became my partner at Current Records. And he said, I got the money. What do we do now? And I said, well, let's call Richard Branson and say, either you got the money or you lose the band. The whole money, the whole $225,000.
Yeah, the originally agreed upon
amount.
And
I eventually got Richard in on his island at Necker in the Virgin Islands. And after about a week and a half of trying, and I said, look, Richard, it's untenable, the $80,000 or $90,000. We got Daniel Lanois as our producer. The guy's going to be a superstar and do you too eventually. You don't know that, neither do I now, but he is great. And we need that kind of money to pay him. And he said, I just can't do that, Jerry. I'm sorry. And I'd known Richard from our days when we handled Virgin Records at PolyGram, so I knew him pretty well. So I said, okay, fair enough. I want the publishing back as well as the record rights. And the contract needed annulled, and he said, fair enough. And about a week later, I got it. And 2 days after that, we signed Martha and the Muffins, and that was our first band. And about a year after that, Danny Lanois, while we were producing the Martha and the Muffins album, Danny Lanois said, do you know a band called V? And I said, well, I've heard of them. I've heard of them. I haven't seen them. He said, well, they're now called the Parachute Club. And I'd heard about this from Richard O'Brien, who ran the Bamboo, too. And so they said, well, you should come and see this band, Jerry. You might want to sign them for Current Records. So I went down into this After Hours Club and signed them, saw them. And they only had one song at that time they'd written called Alienation. And I recognized it as being not a cover. And I said to Lorraine Segato and Billy Bryans afterwards, you guys want a deal? And they said, well, we only got one song. And I said, yeah, it's that one called Alienation. They said, yeah. And I said, well, if you've written that one, you can write a bunch more. So after a little while, a few days checking on me and finding out I was legit, they signed with Current Records, and we recorded the first album with Daniel Lanois, and of course came up with Rise Up and a bunch of other things. And what they did with their advance, we gave them about $20,000 advance to get busy writing and the rest of it. They took their advance money, much like the Mamas and Papas, split down to Trinidad and Tobago for Carnival, got all soaked up all that atmosphere and all that music, and then started to write Rise Up and all the bunch She Tells You and all these other ones. So it came on the first album. So
Money well invested.
Yeah,
as
really.
It turned out.
Was the single of the year in 1983 in Canada.
That's terrific. Jerry Young is in the studio with us. His book is Pop Goes the Weasel, Rock and Roll Off the Record. We'll be back with more in the studio on In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010.
This is In the Studio with Bob Reed and Blair Peckham on News Talk 1010.
The aforementioned Parachute Club, mentioned by the guy who got them a record deal. Jerry Young is his name, and Pop Goes the Weasel, Rock and Roll Off the Record is his book.
Not only got them a record deal, gave them a record deal, and managed them as well. That's right, Jerry. You tell a backstage story about Parachute Club's Lorraine Segato, who, under the influence of Hall & Oates' John Oates, who was producing them at the time, wanted to turf the late Billy Bryans from the band. What went on there?
You know, that's one of those situations where I think Lorraine, you know, she was recording in New York. She spent a lot of time with John Oates while the band's album was being done, co-produced by him down there. And I went down. It was out of the blue to me. I went down because there was a screw-up in the studio with Frank Filippetti, the engineer. So I had to go down and check on what tapes were still viable and which ones were no good anymore. Went to Electric Ladyland immediately from the airport and listened to the tapes that were there and found out that, in fact, not everything was ruined. Out of about five songs, two were salvageable. So we hadn't lost everything, but we'd probably lost about 30 grand. So I obviously had to come back to Toronto after the weekend and go up to RCA with my tail between my legs and beg for more money, which we got. But while I was down there, after I dealt with the studio situation, Lorraine said, why don't we go for a walk in the park, Central Park? I said, sure. So we went for a walk in the park, and she said, I got a couple of questions for you. What do you think of Tommy Mottola co-managing the band? And I thought to myself, well, it's interesting. I said, well, Tommy no doubt can do a lot more for the band in the States than I can. I said, but he can have the States, and I'll have the rest of the world. And it's 50-50. And she said, okay, I'll take that back to Tommy. What do you think of getting rid of Billy and getting another drummer? I said, well, I think that's ridiculous because Billy's part of the band. It's a communal band. He's your partner. He's a co-founder.
Yeah.
He's the glue that keeps it together. And I didn't say this, but he's my best friend in the band. So I said, I think that's a big mistake to even consider that. She says, well, you know, John and Tommy Mottola have said that they think there's a lot better drummers around. And I said, well, that may be true technically. There probably are. But that doesn't mean anything in terms of this band. This band needs Billy to stay together.
It's funny, you know, I've had that pulled on me a few times by producers and by record companies where they say, you know, you really have to have you have to get a different drummer. And in different situations with different drummers. And what they fail to understand is if the person is part of the co-op band, it's a cooperative band and they're part of the sound, their limitations make up part of that sound.
Right.
And putting a better drummer, it's like putting Steve Gadd in the Beatles.
It changes the whole dynamic of everything.
Yeah.
And I think to give Lorraine credit, I think she knew this.
She recognized that.
And she recognized that, but I think she was, you know, she's down there around these guys who've got hit records coming out their ears.
Yep.
They're telling her there's big money out there to be made. There's, you know, we got a few changes we'd like you to make. one with your management, we'll take half. The other one with the drummer, get rid of him. But I think, to give her credit, she decided that was a sort of foolish move, and Billy stayed with him till the end.
Jerry Young, great stories for us here. Are you involved in the business these days?
Absolutely. Yeah. Running Current Management. I'm not with the record company anymore, but I run Current Management, and I have six artists on my label right now.
Well, listen, continued success. That's wonderful. And that website, currentmanagementmgmt.com, to find out more about Jerry Young and his book, Pop Goes the Weasel, Rock and Roll Off the Record, available now through, as we say, Amazon and anywhere you can find books. Thanks again, Jerry. Pleasure meeting you.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
You're listening to In the Studio with Bob Reed and Blair Peckham on News Talk 1010.